This is tape number 6 of Goblinhood Satyricon. Copyright 1995 by James Beatty. Read by Goblinhood. This tape begins in the middle of what I guess is the second chapter 22 in the novel. This is the chapter that was written by the character named St. Cloud. I actually saw God as like a child who was just now waking up. A little thoughtless, perhaps, and a lot cranky, waiting, no doubt, for that first cup of coffee in the morning. I don't know how many people prayed to this particular god. For all I knew, I might be the only supplicant that it had, but I thought it was important to maintain whatever contact there was, and to possibly try to educate the god so that it would look more kindly upon humans. Mostly I just talked to it a lot in my mind, but I also prayed for protection against the horrors that I knew this world was capable of inflicting upon me and upon any loved ones that I had. And I hoped my prayers would cause God to look more closely into some of those horrors from the human point of view. Sometimes I also prayed for things that I really needed badly, or wanted badly enough that it seemed like need. Once, for instance, I needed $60 for something, and I prayed really hard for that. And that same day I found $64 on the sidewalk, in the rain, without a soul around to try and return it to. So my prayer was answered, and I even got to spend the extra $4 on a book that I'd been wanting. Usually, though, I was afraid to ask for anything except basic protection, unless I was really desperate, because there seemed a downside to all this. Even that money had been somebody's loss. Perhaps I should have just left it there in the rain. The difference between my God and the Christian God was a matter of nuance, or perhaps of attitude, but it seemed an important difference to me. Take the story of Hypatia, which I first heard from Carl Sagan while watching his Cosmos show on TV. Hypatia was a great scholar and thinker of the ancient world, born in Alexandria circa 370 AD. She earned great renown for her study of mathematics and philosophy. She was also renowned for her great beauty, if that matters. Sagan suavely pointed out how hard it was for a woman back then to achieve even respect, much less some great and important position in life, unless, of course, she happened to be a queen or something. And yet he asserted, if I remember it correctly, that Hypatia, no queen, was the last head, though no queen, was the last head librarian of what was left of the Library of Alexandria, repository for all the knowledge of the Western world at that time. Hypatia was also a leader of the Neoplatonic school of thought, for whatever that's worth. But she had an enemy, this learned librarian, because all these events were transpiring at the dawn of the internecine Christian empire, which eventually prevailed against its external opponents and which now dominates at least half the world. The church hated the Alexandrian Library, Hypatia, and anything else that the church thought of as pagan, including Hypatia's alleged affair with Orestes, a Roman prefect. Hypatia's chief human adversary was Cyril of Alexandria, patriarch of Alexandria and doctor of the church, a Christian bigwig who put in much of his time persecuting Jews and even other Christians. He particularly seems to have hated Nestorians for not believing exactly the same rubbish about Christianity that his own faction believed. Cyril presided over the Council of Ephesus, which in 431 AD helped to hammer out the concept of Christian heresy, which eventually caused Christians to choose to ignore, among other things, and on pain of death, that two of the biblical apostles, for example, described different birthplaces and places of birth, and even different lineages for Jesus. But I wonder if he had the same mother each time, using that same story about God knocking her up to two different Joes in two different places about a year apart. Anyway, Cyril hated other Christians passionately, but he still had plenty of hatred left over for pagans too, and one of the people that he hated most was Hypatia. And you can bet that Cyril wasn't exactly weeping when he heard that Hypatia was no more. Carl Sagan tells us that Hypatia was accosted by an angry mob, by an angry Christian mob on her way to work one day or something, and flayed to death with abalone shells. One can't help wondering if they salted her wounds as they went along, and just how many precious Bibles, if any, might have wound up being bound in her flayed skin. Sagan states that the library's remnants were later burned by Christian zealots, thus affecting the lobotomy of Western thought. According to Sagan, Hypatia's murderers were working for Cyril, while even the usually conservative 1959 edition of Collier's Encyclopedia states, in volume 10, page 315, that Hypatia was murdered in 1415, in 415, presumably by fanatical Christians, and with at least the knowledge of Saint Cyril of Alexandria. The article goes on to state that, like the library itself, none of her writings survive. And yes, Cyril became a saint, sometimes known as Saint Cyril of the Abalone Shells. Thus, at least some Christians are allowed by the Christian God and encouraged by their religious leaders to venerate this bloodthirsty pre-Byzantine prick as a great leader and purifier of that monolithic dogma which now helps to strangle the human psyche. As for my God, by its indifferent standards, Hypatia was just another innocent bystander, casualty of a virulent and ruthless power struggle, who might as well have been murdered by Billy the Kid, except that the Kid would probably have just shot her instead of flaying her to death. I must admit, though, that the successes and widespread prevalence of walking dung heaps like Saint Cyril argue strongly for the existence of some kind of venomous Christian God. but no god that I'd want to be associated with. And what about my god? Why, for example, have I been speaking of it in the past tense? Or part of that is just the narrative approach I'm using here. But I must admit that strange changes have been taking place in my religion lately. But I don't want to get ahead of my story. Originally, I conceived of my god as sexually neutral and largely inhuman, composed, I guess, of a kind of universal sentience. Despite this, I often thought of it as largely female, probably in part because I see the male biology itself as simply an evolutionary variation on female biology designed to facilitate reproduction. And besides, I tend to like females better than males, which makes it easier for me to have to love a quasi-female god. And though love and patience were always necessarily key elements in my celestial education strategy of dealing with God, I believe that while patience can be faked, love, to be effective, must be real, or at least sincere. And such were my own needs. I must admit that in times of great happiness, I couldn't help loving this God, just for being there, to the point where I felt that my heart must surely burst. And sometimes God would answer my prayers or even just my needs in such a way as to make me think that my love was being reciprocated. A good example would be the timing of Des Garm's visit, which seemed, unbeknownst to Garm, like a playful reward of sorts for my doing that outline, which, in and of itself, encouraged me to go on working no matter how weird it felt. Yet lately, things had become strained in my relationship with God in ways that seemed very general, though the treasonal still helped me to achieve that exalted state of loving devotion and communion that I so craved. But God had seemed distant and unconcerned with me, for the most part, since earlier that month, before I ever even started writing this document. For years up to that point, I'd relied on a kind of mantra to reinforce my prayers, a poem, actually, or rather a passage from the novel The Beautiful Losers by Leonard Cohen, which was later set to music by Buffy St. Marie as the song God is Alive, Magic is Afoot. For some reason or another, I'd been chanting this in my mind for years, every time I was under stress, as part of my slowly evolving religion. It had always seemed to work, too. Despite that, however, I'd lately experienced a series of mishaps while chanting it, and had become so alarmed that I'd abandoned it as a prayer or a charm. Instead, I now chanted as continuously as possible in my mind an even stranger Martian mantra taught me for this purpose by my friend Goblinhood. It seemed to work better. But God still seemed pretty remote, as if some impending disaster were about to come between us, regardless. It was unsettling, to say the least, and things had gotten to the point where Smiley, Glittermouth, and even the dinosaur were urging me to join them in something called the Renegade Club with the understanding that God could join too, unless God, for some unknown reason, was really pissed off at us. The whole thing was a bit like forming a union, I guess. Anyway, despite that vague evidence of communion, following the outline, I was too hungover to pray very fervently at this point. I wished that I could take enough treason on now to get closer to God, or even that I could take some acetaminophen to get rid of my splitting headache. But I knew it would upset my stomach, which was empty, and I was nauseated to the core and unable to eat. So instead I just sat there on my back porch, looking at the stars and thinking about the novel so far, trying to decide if it was worth finishing or not. In many ways, I couldn't understand the novel's existence at all. Originally, I tried to write an epic poem that could accompany and be illustrated by a series of 30 or so blatantly pornographic drawings, my so-called venereal vestals. Though I regarded these figure studies as some of my best work, I'd also had mixed feelings and been haunted by vague sensations of guilt about drawing them. And yet one of these drawings was like an Ark of the Covenant for my religion. And perhaps it also best illustrates how close my relationship with God was becoming. I'd been celibate, as far as contact with others was concerned, for over 7 years, and this was the second time that it happened during my adult life. This celibacy was like an emotional quarantine intended to protect myself from hurting others, as I'd found no form of human intimacy that didn't ultimately make both me and my partners miserable. I'd long since stopped praying for God to fix me up with a partnership that wouldn't cause any misery, figuring that God must have wanted me isolated for some reason, or this wouldn't be going on in the first place. This way of life was probably best for me, since hurting others feels as bad as hurting myself. But it was also very lonely and alienating for me. Worse yet, while I could live without sexual interaction, I couldn't live without sex itself. My drive is strong, even at 42, and it couldn't all be sublimated into paintings and poetry. Fortunately, masturbation was second nature, or even first nature, to me. But by this time I couldn't do it very often without the use of what I call corn porn, of which I'd gradually assembled a pretty substantial collection. But sometimes when the lack of real sex started really getting me down, or when I had some extra spending money and wanted a real treat, I'd have to refresh my supply by skulking off to some sleazy adult bookstore for some more expensive corn porn magazines. And I'd never been quite sure how God viewed these excursions, but I'd always gotten away with them as if they were a lesser evil in a nominally worthy cause. Anyway, about a year ago, I'd gotten into a really painful situation by having actually inadvertently fallen in love with someone that I knew from my sporadic involvement with the local arts community, which would seem to plead a good case for total non-involvement with the outside world. At any rate, there wasn't a chance in hell for a relationship there, even without my quasi-self-imposed celibacy routine. Sadly, even close friendship was problematical. So the misery I was going through was completely pointless, and I wanted it to stop. Said misery was probably enhanced, unfortunately, by the effects of treasonal, which always heightened my emotions, particularly the berserk ones. This had happened once before, though, just before I started taking treasonal. The emotion was more of an infatuation, and thus a weaker force. But I'd happened, by chance, to buy some corn porn that just happened to feature a model who looked quite like my enamorata, if that's the right word. And it turned out that this fact took the purely physical or carnal edge off of my desire, which then evolved into just sort of a spiritual attitude coupled with a latent emotional vulnerability toward that particular woman, whom I seldom ran into anyway. So for this later crisis of the heart, doomed from its inception, I wanted that to happen again. In fact, I desperately needed it to happen again as effectively as possible. I was frantic to put that passion on ice, or at least on hold. Unfortunately, I didn't have much money, and buying expensive shrink-wrapped corn porn magazines is always sort of a crapshoot. It's like buying a pig in a poke. Or that is, a poke at a pig, maybe, or rather. Well, anyway, I'd only get one chance this time. It would either work or it wouldn't. So I desperately prayed like a lost soul on that occasion, though I also asked God to help me chill the hots I was feeling by any means at all, without the other person being affected at all. So far, I'd kept my tortured position from being known to others, let alone to her, and I aimed to go on keeping it that way, and keeping what little dignity I still had. To make a long story short, the porn not only worked, but was also the best such material that I'd ever seen. I guess the rest of my prayer worked as well, because my fixation dimmed down to a dull, cold ache of the emotions whenever my object of deranged and quixotic love, pure and chaste from afar, happened to be around. But the magazine I'd wound up with was so damn good as to wipe out my lust on the Desaad principle. According to the legend that he gave up real orgies as pale in comparison to the fictional ones he created on paper, the model resembled my would-be lover in some pictures, though not on the cover, which meant that I'd been buying the thing in the dark. But with such an idealized semblance, and such a virtual powerhouse in her own right, as to blow away my mere furtive fumblings of desire toward one who was, at best, a poor substitute for the smirking hellcat in God's corn porn offering. Best of all, the model in question either really liked what she was doing, or else she was the best damned actress that I'd ever seen in this soft underbelly of X-rated showbiz sleaze. She seldom touched her always gaping pussy, which nonetheless seemed to drool a kind of orgasmic slime as she got fucked up the butt. Her smile was dazzling, and it seemed authentic for the most part. In any case, I would have gladly French kissed her classy little anus for the rest of my life. Anyway, this model became the foundation of my drawing series as a tribute to God's taste in women, or to God's taste in porn, or to God's sympathy for my pathetic dilemma, or to something. She even got me drawing things twice with blue and black pencil before inking them to bring the drawings a little closer to perfection. I mean, she was overwhelming, virtually intoxicating. Her stiff little tits even stiffened my tits. Because of her, my venereal vestals seemed to me like a Sistine Chapel ceiling in pen and ink, waiting for a sort of Rosetta Stone to be written for them. But what about said Rosetta Stone? I couldn't even understand the first few pages of it, apart from their having started out as a kind of clipped, elusive poetry. I also recognized that they were set at a specific point in time and space, the day that I hitchhiked to a nearby small town's post office for logistic reasons that I no longer remember to register for the draft. So I must have just turned 18, and it must have been a fairly mild late September day in 1969. I was sick as hell at some point from being up all night on caffeine pills and from not eating anything lately except some crappy confection and a little soda. But now, I no longer remember, perhaps thanks to all this, all the treasonal, just why I'd opened the quondam poem with that particular scene. For the rest, there were plenty of lurid scenes to come, involving weird sex and drugs. But the drug stuff I could probably stick the dinosaur with, the poor dumb jerk. I'd stick him with the sexual material as well if I thought there was anything even remotely erotic about a dinosaur with its own scaly head stuck squarely up its own reptilian ass. Anyway, I still had bad qualms about both the pictures and the text. It all seemed like something that I'd want very much to tear up someday. An attitude which underwrites my failure to write more than I do. And as I sat looking at my backyard in whatever moonlight there was, I thought back to an experience from my painting career, a raging controversy at a small college town where my work was labeled obscene, pornographic, blasphemous, and outright satanic. One Bush League commentator, among many similar spin doctors concerning me, remarked, "I wish somebody would just shoot the bastard and leave him to rot in his yard." Such was my mood now that I could almost see myself rotting out there. Actually, I've always felt that there should be a special TV channel you could tune into and watch a constantly replayed tape of the shooting, followed by stages of composition so far, and ending with 5 or 10 minutes of live rotting in progress. Still, it depressed me now more than I already was. Worse yet, I suspected that the treasonal might be really badly messing me up, or even killing me, and I couldn't persuade myself that that wasn't okay with me, despite my raging but furtive guilt trip on the subject. We all know the cost of living these days, but what is the price of a life? What subjective, bottom line deal is prerequisite to a given person's desire to live. In my case, both my art and my religion were highly necessary to my survival instinct, and were both lavishly intertwined with each other, and by now, with the trees and all. As I no doubt imperfectly understood it, I was actually addicted to experiencing a near constant adrenaline rush for 3 days or so at a time. I knew this couldn't be good for my heart after a year and a half at my age, but I didn't give a damn. Better a quick early death, in my view, than a slow deterioration a few more frustrated years down the road. All I wanted was to be working at my best capacity when death came, and I also wanted to be in a state of grace with my God, whatever that meant, at the time of my demise. Frankly, I never thought twice about jonesing out on treasonal, especially because it kept me in a constant state of grace most of the time, a state in which I passionately loved God almost incessantly and was even learning to sort of love myself. In fact, since the recent corn porn epiphany, I'd farmed a lot of that futile adoration I was stuck with out to God, and some of it had spilled over onto me. Although that would sound pretty silly, I guess, to a reader whose self-esteem had always resided immaculately at the dead center of his or her universe. Most of you, that is, by your behavior, anyway. In short, I was happy as hell that I had a goodly treasonal stash and that there would always be plenty more where that came from, just as there would always be plenty of commercial host wafers and communion wine for those of that religious persuasion. But right now I felt myself very slowly dying, much faster than I normally would have done, and I wondered if Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals was truly worth it, or if any of my work was. Not that I wanted much to live, or actually feared death, mind you, as opposed to being screamingly afraid of the act of dying. But I finally found solace of a sort there on my porch, in the words of a science fiction writer that I remembered from my recent reading jag. That of that SF omnibus had ended with a story entitled Dory Bangs by Bruce Sterling, which first appeared in the September 89 issue of Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction magazine. This was a sort of what-if alternate reality story in which the titular protagonist is at one point comforted, a bit like Bloom in James Joyce's classic Ulysses, by a vision of the child she never had, who says things like, "So that's enough. Just to shelter each other and help each other up. Everything else is gravy. Someday, no matter what, you go down forever. Art can't make you immortal. Art can't change the world. Art can't even heal your soul. All it can do is maybe ease the pain a bit, or make you feel more awake, and that's enough." Which really quite touched me now for some reason. And so, armed with my own personal take on this relatively cheerless credo, not caring either way about the work for a while, I prepared to go in and face the challenge of breakfast as the wistful stars faded into the glowering dawn. But first I jury-rigged an actual little vomitorium of my own out of paper and plastic bags, just in case. And sure enough, as soon as my food was prepared, I started violently spewing yellowish bile mixed with nothing whatsoever. Note to projectile vomiting aficionados: for best results, never run out of projectiles. The intensity of my uncontrollable spasms alarmed me, but when they subsided, I was able to wash my mouth out and to eat, and afterwards, I slept again. After I awoke that night, of course, I got really out there on Treasonal again, but I also wrote up some 30 or 40 manuscript pages, thus significantly advancing my work. And there's no end in sight, except possibly for an accumulative overdose of Treasonal, someday a fatal overdose. But my attitude remains, what a way to go. And so there was St. Cloud's latest chapter, all typed up and singing hymns to extol the dubious virtues of Treasonal. But the situation was even worse now that this chapter had become virtually a relic of a lost world. I'd only seen the author himself once since this Treasonal debacle, and I hadn't liked what I'd seen. I was also disturbed by certain revelations showing up in his book. I didn't know what to think about St. Cloud's God, but the results of the artist's prayers sounded to me a lot like my own quirky brand of psionics. But St. Cloud wasn't aware of even the possible existence of such dangerous abilities. Obviously, he had no idea about how to safely use them. So far, his concept of God had restrained his use of the wild talent, but now, when I saw St. Cloud the day after his discovery of the Treasonal snafu, the same day he raved about trying to weather the storm on caffeine pills, he seemed half dead in spirit. His easy faith in God had clearly deserted him. He didn't want to believe in a cruel God, so he couldn't believe in any God at all. He was soul sick and devastated. All a delusion, moaned St. Cloud, and now I'm stuck in a future without even Treasonal to enhance that delusion. Look, St. Cloud, I tried to remonstrate. It's not the end of the world, you know. End of the world, he croaked, gaping blearily at me from within the midst of his head-swimming Treasonal funk. End of the world? You poor damned fool, it's the end of God. I could see his point, of course, but I'd had no idea that he was so devoted to his religious belief system. Now that the world was pulling his wings off, he was rubbing salt in his own wounds. Distinctly uncomfortable, I begged out and scuttled home with the manuscript for chapter 22 of Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals. I wanted to type it as quickly as possible to give St. Cloud what pleasure I could while there was still time. I didn't know how much longer he'd last. He was twitching out on Treasonal, had been, in fact, for a long time. But the fun was almost over now, and it had cost him his god. I didn't know what to do, apart from harboring a very bad feeling about the whole thing. Since then, I'd only seen Smiley. That was a few days later, and the situation had evidently deteriorated further, with Smiley taking that gumshoe noir routine of theirs to the point of absurdity. Glittermouth, lost in some analogous literary quagmire, and St. Cloud flipping out as if he were trying to crack the case of the missing god or something. I didn't look forward to seeing Raymond again. He didn't seem likely to bounce back like I'd hoped he would, or to be philosophical about it like Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s drug-addicted president in the novel Slapstick. Come to think of it, that withdrawal hadn't been any piece of cake either, as I seem to remember it. Meanwhile, chapter 22 was really starting to bother me. If St. Cloud's god had buggered off somewhere in his worldview, or had, as seemed more probable, never existed to begin with, then St. Cloud would likely be putting two and two together toward regarding the psionic implications of certain facts. And that bothered me, scared me, in fact. St. Cloud didn't know jack shit about being harmless with those kinds of powers. And if his only advisors were assholes like the Dinosaur or Glittermouth or even Smiley, well, I didn't want to think about the potential damage which St. Cloud might inadvertently visit upon his unsuspecting world. Combined the amazed eureka of newly discovered power with poor St. Cloud reeking of sick, paranoid fear, let alone any painful withdrawal symptoms. And you have St. Cloud maybe wreaking havoc of heretofore unimaginable proportions upon his depressing little continuum. I tried to think of a way to help him without flooding his world, or at least his little corner of it, with other dimensional Treasonal, because he was right. The drug was in fact killing him more quickly than otherwise. In addition to destroying his mind, it was a John Barr hinge, and I didn't want to mess with it. But all I could think of, ironically, was that I should try to get across to him how stupid he was being to explain the end of his novel as early as chapter 22, or at any other point until he actually had to, for that matter, considering the ludicrous nature of the ending itself. Chillingly, though, I was forced to consider the strong possibility that he'd abandoned his novel by now anyway. I needed to see him to know how he was doing, but I didn't want to face him. So I decided to send the typescript of his chapter 22 over via a somewhat less shakable envoy. I was hoping that Goblinhood could talk some sense into St. Cloud. The door was open, so Goblinhood walked on in. He found Glittermouth in the middle room this time, wearing those same whodunit threads of Smiley's, but bent over the coffee table desk this time, a cigarette clamped between his garish painted teeth, feverishly studying some incoherent notes. The glimpse G.H. got of them went like this. 1. Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. 2. Fuck it, Seamus, it's the big goodbye. 3. Let's go, Jack, it's Chinatown. 4. Freak out, Flatfoot, it's the long sleep. 5. Come off it, Jick, it's Chinatown. 6. Far out, fuckface, it's Bummertown. 7. For God's sake, Joker, it's a high window of opportunity. 8. Fly by night, jerk, it's Dinertown. 9. How now, Lake? It's the lady and the jock. 10. How the hell, Watson, did you come to know my methods? 11. Odds bodkins, Juke, it's a thin man for all that. 12. Call a Sam a spade there, bogey, it's the stuff dreams are made of. Without trying to make sense of said rigmarole, Goblin Hood stood before Glittermouth's desk and lit a smoke of his own. I need to see St. Cloud, he said tersely. Yeah, sure, pal, leered the grinning gargoyle, playing with a toy squirt gun atop his desk. You may think you need to see him, but you sure as hell don't want to see him, no matter what you think. Just get him, growled Goblin Hood. Wait in the reception area, barked Glittermouth, pointing. Asshole, thought G.H. as he went back into St. Cloud's cluttered front parlor. For all its speedy, keen joie de vivre, or whatever, Treasonal evidently didn't mix well with good housekeeping. G.H. sat down on a short, rubbishy couch which was covered by a really tawdry, really tacky, really garish tapestry in imitation of Leonardo's Last Supper, reportedly given to St. Cloud by a close friend. It actually looked pretty good on that couch, almost 3D in some weird fashion. Goblin Hood's eye was caught for a while by a nearby art piece of St. Cloud's. A small title card proclaimed it to be called Dry Season. It was a large fishbowl containing colored rocks, a castle, and a dried up seahorse, but no water. Atop the bowl was a battered hat, similar to the one Glittermouth had been sporting. G.H. couldn't help wondering if this artifact was of recent vintage. Neither of us had ever seen it before. Meanwhile, Glittermouth was taking his own sweet time. Or maybe St. Cloud was being indisposed. G.H. shifted in his seat and studied the room in greater detail, noticing at last that the corners and other odd floor spaces were ankle deep in empty Treasonal bottles, dead soldiers who had given their last measure. It looked like the rotting corpse of this world's chance of surviving St. Cloud, for whom each of those relics gave some mute testimony concerning the existence or non-existence, or the sheer cruelty, or even just plain indifference of God. When St. Cloud finally came in from the middle room, Goblin Hood took back what he'd called Glittermouth in his mind. Glittermouth was right, panic-stricken. I don't want to see St. Cloud. No wonder the boss bailed out and sent me. St. Cloud's feverish, darting eyes, the jerking twitch of his head, the tremors in his hands, all told their own story. He was all jacked up on treasonal, in the throes of a major and now illegal binge, but with no joy this time. He looked like a man who really liked to breathe and who was using up the last air on the planet. His face was hollow, sunken. His resigned slouch made him seem shriveled and defeated. He even made Glittermouth look good. In one hand, St. Cloud carried a book, and in the other, a bottle of pills. G.H. thought he recognized this scene from a million westerns, High Noon, the middle of the street. But he can't throw down yet, yammered Goblin Hood's mind desperately. I'm only an innocent bystander. Welcome to the crash of 94, intoned St. Cloud in the sepulchral voice of the damned. Still and all, you're looking pretty chipper, chirped Goblin Hood feebly in a cracking voice. Anyway, haha, at least if you have to jump out the window, you're on the ground floor. What? What? Responded St. Cloud blankly, having not been listening or having forgotten what the conversation was supposed to be about. Trouble is, reasoned Goblin Hood silently, the stuff won't stay forgotten. He decided to try again. See here, St. Cloud, this won't do. There are limits, you know. G.H. stranded himself. I know, said St. Cloud, not knowing anything. He idly dropped the plastic bottle on the floor without even noticing it. G.H. scrambled to pick it up. It was full of small treasonal tabs. 1,000 hits, eh? What's that, like a month's supply for you by now? Wondered the masked buffoon. More like 2 weeks, mumbled St. Cloud absently. But it won't have to last that long. This is the last treason all around, you know. God in a jar. You can't get there from here anymore. But so what, right? Goblin Hood didn't like this at all. To hell with the Prime Directive, or whatever it was. He decided to grab the situation firmly by its John Barr hinge. Suppose I could get you a steady supply of treasonal, he began. St. Cloud eyed him with a wild, bleary take. Treasonal. You damned fool, I don't care about treasonal. Fuck treasonal. I want God back, can you get me that? How can I worship something that lets all those petty politicking pricks out there shove their hypocritical fucking drug war of my life. How can I worship something that I can't love? Bemused, Goblinhood decided to change the subject. Been reading, I see, he quavered. Suddenly, St. Cloud seemed to have been shocked, temporarily back to some earlier, obsessive reality. He hefted the battered old paperback with a strange gleam in his eye. To the dark star, he said. The microcephalon is silent. Then he turned and wandered out of the room in the direction of his desk. Following that, Goblinhood just sat around in the reception area waiting to get kicked out, wondering what to do next. There didn't really seem to be much that he could do next. He'd failed in whatever his mission had actually been, and he wasn't in any hurry to get back to headquarters and report that fact. So he contented himself with idly counting the busted treasonal markers languishing around on the floor, multiplying them by the pills they'd once contained. Goblinhood. 33,000, 34,000, eh? Were you going to leave that with me? It was Smiley in his private investigator ensemble. He pointed at the thick manila envelope which Goblinhood still carried but had totally forgotten about. Oh yeah, remembered Goblinhood. Chapter 22. He handed it over. Smiley opened the envelope and casually thumbed through its contents. Hot stuff, A.G.H.? Smiley, what's going to happen? Wish the fuck I knew, Watson, mumbled Smiley, trying to light a meerschaum pipe. He's keeping the lid on pretty tight. What about that book, that SF story, that weird gleam in his eye? One of that, Smiley sounded almost exasperated. One does sort of wish that Silverberg could have been a bit more upbeat. I suppose it was that new wave thing back then. I've read the story, replied Goblinhood, and I can see the way it connects with St. Cloud's sense of alienation. So, what's he doing? Just feeling sorry for himself? I think he's more interested in the hard science aspect, mumbled Smiley, looking for all his pallid jocularity, as old and crushed as Kilgore Trout at the end of Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s Breakfast of Champions. This really did put the chill into Goblinhood, who was suddenly anxious to report back to headquarters after all. But he hid this response as best he could, not wanting to alarm his host. Science fiction, he mumbled. Literature of the future. There is no future, stated Smiley flatly. But we all thought we'd fly through space to the farthest star before long, gibbered Goblinhood. Thought we'd just toddle on over and rub elbows with the Galactic Council, what? World by the tail and all that rot, what? World by the tail, smiled Smiley coldly. By the way, tell your boss that St. Cloud never read the story until after I did. Nobody pays any attention to Glittermouth but me. So you see, knowledge can be dangerous after all. So that was the John Barr hinge all along, wondered G.H. with a dry mouth. That story. The real hinge, agreed Smiley crisply. It provided him with his perfect little Gutterdammerung, like Hitler in his bunker. There's no stopping him now, I don't suppose. Of course, Smiley purred, knowing everything. You'll be nicely out of harm's way. Can't you do anything? Rasped Goblin Hood, as if rasping could help. Ha! Barked Smiley. You know better. I'm just a secondary persona like you, just a salty old sea dog adrift on this sinking derelict. But he's the captain. A tertiary persona, according to the dinosaur. Goblin Hood couldn't keep himself from muttering. I think you'd better leave now, beamed Smiley, icily. Wait, he amended, leaving the room as Goblin Hood rose to go. Smiley shortly returned with a large cardboard portfolio. He slipped the Chapter 22 typescript into it. Take this, said Smiley. The next few chapters? Asked Goblin Hood. There won't be any more chapters, sighed Smiley tiredly. This is the whole book so far. Maybe you or your pal can think up a better ending. A better title, even. No, wait, Smiley, this is... yelped Goblin Hood as Smiley pushed him and the portfolio out the door. It isn't farewell, G.H., came the sotto voce response. It's Chinatown. The door slammed in Goblin Hood's face for good, and a whole world of potentials seemed to slam shut with it. It was Chinatown. Goblin Hood lost no time in clearing out of the immediate neighborhood, but again found himself reluctant to go straight home. I can always say I missed the bus, he muttered as he wandered down the same dingy street through several layers of space-time. He wanted to stash the portfolio somewhere until he could study its contents and decide what to do with them. Beyond that, he had no immediate goal. He wandered for quite a while, imagining a further conversation with Smiley. What's Roman Polanski going to think about all this Chinatown jazz? Quipped Goblin Hood glibly. He'd probably slit my nose with a knife, grinned Smiley gleefully, if I had a nose. Anyway, if they filmed this, he'd probably be played by Pee-wee Herman. And if they filmed this, maybe Robert Silverberg could be played by Christopher Lee, joked the old gobster. Abruptly, Smiley's mood plummeted again. They won't be filming this, he mumbled dejectedly. Well, it was a pretty depressing story, Silverberg's To the Dark Star. It concerned a mutually antagonistic crew of three, human, humanoid, and alien, who go to observe the death agonies of a giant star following its supernova status. One of them, however, must risk madness or even fatality to monitor its final collapse right out of the universe. Come on, Smiley. Can't you take a joke? Whined Goblin Hood. But Smiley couldn't take a joke. The imaginary conversation was over. Goblin Hood finally wound up in a seedy, interdimensional dive, a lowbrow beer joint, reputedly a hangout for off-duty I-Corps agents or something. And it was there that he learned about St. Cloud's grim fate. For some reason, TV's Perry Mason theme was playing repeatedly on the obscure jukebox. Goblin Hood sat at the bar, nursing a cold cup of coffee, thinking distractedly about the portfolio at his feet. A tapping sound next to him caught his attention. A squirrel sat there on the bar, next to a typewriter. It had typed out, with its snout, "You come here often?" They got to talking. The squirrel looked like the Shogun squirrel might have looked, despite the tiny trench coat, hat, and meerschaum pipe. It sipped whiskey and beer through respective straws, a boilermaker for a hard-boiled squirrel, which had also been nibbling on bar peanuts and pickled eggs. "A barkeep, more coffee, and another round for my friend here," ordered Goblin Hood. It might have been the Shogun squirrel, or just a highly trained I-Corps agent from a world of shapeshifters or of intelligent squirrels who merely claimed to be the Shogun squirrel. But in any case, this was no ordinary squirrel. It was a very knowledgeable squirrel. It had been around, and it knew all kinds of things. Among other things, it knew how to type. And while Goblin Hood had been almost mindlessly wandering around talking to himself for what seemed like forever, the squirrel had kept its ear to the ground and had ferreted out certain items of information which by that time were common knowledge among the continua. Said nuggets of wisdom, known to everyone except G.H., all concerned what has already been called the grim fate of one Raymond St. Cloud. And it was with a considerable show of zest that the self-important squirrel typed out all pertinent data regarding the ultimate disposition of St. Cloud and of his world. It all had something or other to do with the Chandra Sekhar limit and the Schwarzschild radius or something, typed Goblin Hood's diminutive drinking crony, according to Robert Silverberg. But basically, St. Cloud OD'd on his own psionic power. He converted himself into a giant star with a really dense core. Then he converted all the treasonal he stashed away into hydrogen and then into iron 57 or 56. There followed catastrophic collapse and supernova conditions, neutrinos spewing outward, temperature exceeding 200 billion degrees, all that sort of thing. For a while, he twinkled as brightly as a galaxy. And then, whispered G.H., appalled. And then, typed the squirrel, St. Cloud's density buggered the curvature of space until a state of singularity prevailed. After St. Cloud finally cooled to near zero temperature, his core violently collapsed into a condition of zero volume and infinite density. He was last seen swallowing himself just before he disappeared out of the universe completely. If you ask me, he went out not unlike a scorpion in a ring of fire, stinging its own ass to death. And Smiley, the dinosaur? Faltered Goblinhood. You jerk. The entire system was gone, typed the rodent snappishly. So that was that. Poor St. Cloud. Poor St. Cloud's world. Finally, Goblinhood raised an index finger. One question, he said. His small informant cocked its stupid-looking little mug inquisitively, its fat cheeks crammed with pickled eggs. I thought you guys got really pissed off if someone fed you. The squirrel typed rapidly. So who says I'm not pissed off? Then it popped G.H. in the chops and started taking the place apart. Goblin had got out of there with his portfolio while he still had his pants on. 23. Back in Sodom, my pants were still off, but so were hers now, such as they were. She lay beneath me, staring into my eyes with glittering dark pools where her own eyes should have been. There seemed, somehow, too many of them. But I knew that the ichor, or something, was robbing me of sharp focus. We kissed, and her breath tasted of the ichor as well, but I could still taste her beneath it. She tasted of silken honey. I kissed her again, a long kiss. Beneath all else, I could taste my own cum still on her lips, but I ignored this. I breathed her in, holding it, almost forgetting to breathe again. That would have been all right. She was so delicious, and it had been so long since I'd last kissed or even touched anyone. Kissing her was like being in heaven. And I knew that the ichor was probably going to destroy me, just as it was already melting my perceptions, dissolving my cognitive facilities. But I wanted to believe in her, wanted her to be there for me to the end, no matter what kind of predatory game she was actually playing. And like a child or a puppy or a kitten, at first perplexed by a new game, she caught on and responded to my breathless kiss, creating a small vacuum around our fencing tongues as we solemnly tried to drink each other up. in one long claw. I didn't care who or what she was anymore. Didn't care where we were, or how or why. I only wanted the kiss to go on forever, sucking her essence into me, breathing almost imperceptibly through my nose, imbibing some kind of eternity at that perfect chalice, that holy grail. She lost the pulmonary duel, releasing her breath in gasps of tinkling laughter. I also snickered, but I didn't let it break the spell for me as my mouth started sliding south. I noted that the ichor had at least settled my stomach. I fended off any consideration of what else it might be doing. I'd long known that nausea of the mind, of the soul, is also a grim possibility, on drugs or off of them, and I wasn't feeling that now. There was only this moment left to me, and I wanted it to be all that there ever was again. She still wore her leather jacket, but her full breasts were naked and exposed. Her broad, crinkled areolae were island beaches surrounding stiff, quivering, volcanic cones. I wanted to jack them off, to try teasing milk out of them like spurting cum. But her moans told me how sensitive they were in all their erectile glory. So I contented myself with a few sumptuous hot licks. Then my tongue began traveling in a straight line between them, down her abdomen, playfully rimming her navel. I reached her groin and showered it with breathless ghost kisses that made her gasp. Her hands in my hair pushed me certainly, relentlessly down. I reached that ridiculous patch of pubic fluff, freshly shaved, shaped like time itself. I outlined it with my tongue, wondering what its significance was. And then my tongue trod delicately on the denuded beachhead surrounding the very beginning of that little node of flesh and gristle that so fascinated me, that so resembled an orchid and, in some views, a tiny glands. This illusion enhanced by the nether bulge in either direction of her rugose labia. I teased the hooded knob with the very tip of my tongue, wanting it to swell erect, to squirt some kind of magic chism into my face. Instead, her vagina secreted a gust of musky, intoxicating perfume. I laughed at her dripping cunt, wishing that I could stick my tongue far enough in to reach her legendary G-spot, wherever, whatever that was. But for me, this was all the merest foreplay. Dinner hadn't even truly begun. And Bella Madonna? She was moaning, gasping, even chanting something like a mantra as she writhed beneath my tongue. Processed oleander leaves, saltpeter, oil of peppermint, in a settle P aminophenol zinc oxide. She was quoting, I realized dimly, the ingredients of one version of Yupik from Philip K. Dick's 1969 masterpiece of the same name, Yupik, one of my all-time favorite books. In some ways, it was like the secret formula for God. What was she playing at? And how could she have memorized such a passage for a moment like this? Or was she taking it from my own subconscious, I having read that novel at least 100 times? I returned to drubbing her clit with my tongue as the spell continued. Charcoal, cobalt chloride, caffeine, extract of digitalis, steroids in trace amounts. In The Call of Cthulhu, Lovecraft wrote, "The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far." Maybe so, but it hadn't helped much in the case of Raymond St. Cloud and company. Lickjaw, why spare his feelings now, had read a story and word had leaked out, inspiring the doomed psionic addict to a grandiose act of mass suicide. Even after all this time, I still had trouble facing my own role in that debacle. The oddest thing about interdimensional globetrotting was that St. Cloud's 1994 had been a long time ago for me in goblinhood, though that was the year now, as my home con reckoned things. Goblinhood had last encountered St. Cloud in an alternative future many years ago, shortly after Goblinhood's own creation. The experience had proved formative. Upon his return from that disaster area, Goblinhood had stashed the portfolio where I wasn't supposed to find it, where he could study it at his own leisure, suspecting, I suppose, that my contempt for St. Cloud's writing would inhibit whatever G.H. decided to do about the stuff. But of course I knew all about it, though I pretended otherwise. I was actually glad that something had been salvaged from that whole fiasco, and it gave me a certain leverage for the times when G.H. and I had some disagreement or another, especially regarding his sporadic performance career. And you might be surprised at some of the vicious arguments we had on that score, as the human mind struggled to correlate all its contents. I was oft content to leave him brooding over his other dimensional spoils just to get him off my back. In some ways, of course, Goblinhood had always exhibited St. Cloudist tendencies, his taste in porn being a prime example. The one unknown to most of his fans. But I never realized how far things had gone until it was way too late. Until the advent of the satanic Ameriflora. Periwinkle. The sorcerer's violet. They wore it to the gallows. Mugwort. The stuff that dreams are made of. Ferula. Asafoetida. The feces of Satan. St. John's wort, which blooms on the anniversary of his beheading. Phallus impudicus, a fungus besieged by Victorians. Her fingers had taken over ops regarding her man in the boat, that salty sea dog adrift in pre-orgasmic juices. And her chanting had taken an even more bizarre turn. Still, I recognized it. Enchanter's Nightshade, consecrated to Circe by the Greeks. Vervain, sacred to Romans and Druids alike. Henbane, the devil's eye. Peony, guarded by eye-ripping woodpeckers. Parsley, the devil's signature. Rue, driver out of demons, oft combined with mugwort as a talisman to anoint the forehead. Snapdragon, Satan's beard. Scarlet pimpernel, which can even remove splinters. Field blindweed, the devil's guts. Thistle, Gnaeus benedictus, a ward against illness. Wolfbane, arisen from the foam of Cerberus. Mistletoe, good luck for everyone except Balder. Dracaena Draco, the dragon's blood tree. Marjoram, detector of witches. Mandragora, the hand of glory, spawned from hanged man's semen, found beneath the gallows and steeped in lore. On the cross, Christ refused to be mandragorized. Who did he think he was kidding? Lotus, protection to those who inhale it. And orchids, those decadent eidolons of rotting beauty. All babbled rapidly, only half coherently, like glossolalia. Yet, I recognized the participants of the satanic Ameriflora, Satan's simples, alternating with herbs of grace. I'd originally learned most of this myself, from a book called Bizarre Plants, Magical, Monstrous, Mythical, by William M. Bowden. Macmillan Publishing Company, Inc., 1974. But her recitation of it sounded almost like an epic poem of superstition as I slurped at her twat. 24. And the satanic Ameriflora? A mere satire Goblin Hood whipped up just before his mad dash for the presidency in 1992. The town we lived in was celebrating 500 years of Christopher Columbus with a big expensive flower show for some reason. T.H. was poking fun at it by, for instance, pointing out the satanic aspect of parsley. Part of his show even involved a war crimes tribunal sentencing Columbus to hang an effigy, followed by a madcap science experiment, an effort to grow a plastic mandragora on stage in a jar of dirt from the plastic semen supposedly spurting from the dummy explorer's plastic cock as he supposedly strangled on a very short noose with, alas, inconclusive results. The performance began, however, with a more directly sexual episode that had nothing whatever to do with horticulture, unless it represented the growth of a goblin hoodie and love story of sorts. It's all pretty weird. In some ways, of course, Goblin Hood's infamous safe sex demonstration was sort of botanically oriented, representing, as it did, a perfect metaphorical example of rabbit tobacco, a poor-ass substitute for something on a grand scale. As it happens, the show was also entitled Rabbit Tobacco, but little did anyone know the exact nature or extent of the actual science experiment in progress throughout all this. "I say, old bean," commented Goblin Hood as I tried to compose the performance in question, "what the fuck do you think you're doing? This isn't a performance, it's just a poetry recital. Nobody's going to want to sit through all that crap. Besides, it's got nothing to do with anything." "Oh yeah?" I snarled. "Can you do any better?" And that was how G.H. wound up writing and directing the Satanic Ameriflora, as well as starring in it, although, as usual, he blamed it all on me. Goblin Hood was having this performance videotaped for public access TV and probably just wanted an excuse to wag his ass, my ass, that is, on television for the folks at home. Maybe he was already running for president, secretly, even before the big exorcism at the real Ameriflora that canceled the incumbent on TV. And this was Goblin Hood's way of mooning the electorate and racking up a campaign scandal of sorts. Actually, he was wearing transparent plastic trousers over his our bare ass and over his ridiculous Martian loincloth. But I would never have appeared like that publicly in a million years, let alone on TV. And yet Goblin Hood presented this to his audience, and to me, as a public service.